Welcome, welcome, welcome into another edition of New Track Record. Caleb Hatch with you in studio and joining us from a undisclosed location. It is Justin Kinney. Hello, Justin.
Hello, Caleb. Yes, it's my annual trip down to the Panhandle where I'm continuing to effort a street race of some sort down here.
So you just disclosed the location.
Yes, I did disclose. Well, the old Panhandle's a long stretch of land, so I'm not saying exactly, but if you would guess the Pensacola Beach area, then yes, you would be very correct.
So much for your secret trip trying to plan that street race.
That's right.
Well, here we are, and you know, it was looking like a pretty quiet week in IndyCar, and then we got some interesting nuggets. Nathan Brown of the Indianapolis Star, it was perfect that we waited to record here until Friday here. It's Friday, April 5th, Friday morning here in the U.S. And a very interesting story. We'll talk about IndyCar TV rights. We'll get to that in a bit. Also, charter entries and growing grids in IndyCar as well, all to come on this episode of New Track Records. Let's dive right in. And I think the interesting story, Nathan Brown, IndyStar, IndyStar.com, an excellent read with an update on IndyCar's next TV contract. And this isn't really a secret, but Brown confirming it, it's come down to NBC and Fox. I think we kind of knew that's where this was headed. Now it's a matter of, you know, which route does IndyCar go, and we'll get more into that in a bit. But these are the two players. I think this is a good sign for IndyCar to have two top networks. I know we thought for a long time CW would be that group, and then they had their Xfinity deal. And I think IndyCar looked at CW, as Brown details, but it'd have to be split with another network. IndyCar doesn't want to do that, and rightfully so. We saw that with Versus and ABC, and then Versus became NBC Sports. You don't need that again. And two power players, I think you have to be pretty happy with the options either way.
And what we have been talking about on the podcast with the CW in terms of the money potentially able to be made after we look at their Xfinity deal, really comes into play, too, with NBC and Fox, because per Nathan Brown's excellent article on IndyStar.com, he mentions it would be a noticeable jump into the $30, $35 million range annually that Fox is dangling in front of IndyCar. And meanwhile, NBC, it sounds like they're getting a small bump, but not into the $30 million range. So it's still going to come down for IndyCar is whether you chase the money or you stay with the stability of NBC. And that was kind of going to be the same debate if CW was serious and throwing some big money. So the same decisions need to be made that we've been talking about, but it's going to be between NBC and Fox.
And those are the two that have gone to the forefront. And I think the question mark and really the decision IndyCar has to make both come with their own advantages. Obviously, we talk about NBC, it's stability, right? And you'll get a bump. The current rights fee, Brown says, somewhere between 20 and 25 million. You'll get a bump, but like you said, it's not going to be significant. And you have that stability there. And you're going to get more network races. In terms of out of the 17 races on the calendar, you're going to get more. You know, could you get, say, 10 network races? That's a solid deal. That's way more than what IndyCar used to get in the previous TV deal iteration where you're talking about five. So that's the debate here is, do you get more network races, maybe a little less money and stability, or do you go in a different route with Fox?
And that's one thing that we've looked at with NBC and saying, have we seen the apex of the amount of races that are going to be on network for IndyCar going into the future? Because we're already seeing that downswing the last couple years. And you could say maybe some of it has to do with the Olympics this year, but we're seeing a trend over the last couple years, more races on Peacock, more races on USA. And now NBC is coming back and saying, okay, we'll bump those races back up in terms of network races. And that seems to be their hook. And I think comparatively with Fox, inevitably there will be more races on FS1 and maybe even FS2 than Fox. But it's one of those classic things, you know, where you have to put Fox and NBC on a piece of paper and you write just advantages and disadvantages of each, positives and negatives of each, because you can make a good case, at least as far as we understand it from Nathan Brown's article, for both. And it's just which one has more positives, which one has more negatives, and kind of deciding from there.
So IndyCar currently has 10 network races. If that carries over and they stay with NBC, you feel pretty good about that, right?
Yeah, I feel pretty good. Here's the biggest question, I think, is what constitutes, what's the biggest factor for growth for IndyCar for the next, let's say, 5 years? Is it more network races or current amount of network races or a little bit more, like you're getting at NBC? Or is it a bump of maybe up to $10 million a year in rights fees in what it sounds like Fox would pay? And for a sport and a series that's still trying to balance the books and not have Brickyard and Indy 500 ticket sales basically fund the rest of the series or at least bring it into the black, how important is that? And that's a question we can't answer. We're not in those meetings, but I think they like continuity. We've seen that with NBC. We've seen that with Dallara, right? When they put up the chassis competition, you knew they were going to go back to Dallara anyway. And they like continuity. But I think there's some definite interesting tidbits that Fox could offer. And something that wasn't mentioned in the article that you and I mentioned off air was, what about practices and qualifying, which right now are on Peacock? And there is no equivalent of that, streaming equivalent, for Fox currently. And could those land on FS2 and maybe even FS1 sometimes for qualifying? And how does that help your product? You mentioned the casual viewer that is flipping through or looking at their sports channels and seeing qualifying or practice of IndyCar on FS1 and FS2. You're not stumbling upon that on stream, on Peacock. And how advantageous is that? Yeah, the ratings won't be huge, but it still opens the possibility of people stumbling upon your product. And that's an aspect of the deal that wasn't mentioned in the article that I do think could factor in, is could your practices and qualifying be on over-the-air television as opposed to stream?
And so we talk about network races. IndyCar has seen a reduction. They went from 13 last season on NBC to 10 this year. You can blame the Olympics, whatever, but it's been clear, and Brown details this in the story, talking about NBC has reduced things. They're looking at cutting costs on this deal. They've changed who's calling, you know, the Friday practice sessions, try to save money. They've changed the hotels, which that was something that I did not know. But they've
what
changed.
Are they staying at like some Motel 6s or something?
I hope not.
How much are you really saving on hotels?
I hope not. But think about it. They're bringing Lee Diffie in, you know, for the Saturday and Sunday of a race weekend as opposed to the Friday, Saturday, Sunday. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah.
I've noticed that. But that's been an obvious change. They're trying to save on staffing costs. I get it. These are all factors, right? You've been the partner for a while. It's how can you streamline costs? That's just the nature of business. But that is noticeable. And stuff on Peacock, who knows how much, you know, is NBC satisfied with the Peacock only rate? Like, we'll never know because they're never going to say. If it was so great, they would say something, but I don't think it is. And they're not going to get, you know, numbers of an NFL regular season game, let alone a playoff game. If you get even a tenth of that, you'd be thrilled. So I think that's kind of where things are at with Peacock. And like you said, yeah, in theory, you could discover it on the app, but I don't think you're going to discover it compared to someone channel surfing. And yes, I understand the age differences, right? Streaming is going to be more popular with a younger audience versus, you know, FS2. But we're in that stopgap era, and you kind of have to pick and choose what parts you want when it comes to TV and streaming. And I think that's going to continue to be the case for at least another 5 or 6 years.
Based on what we know from Nathan Brown's article, and there are aspects of it that aren't clear yet, but based on what we know, would you go NBC or Fox right now?
I'd go Fox, and here's why. IndyCar needs money, plain and simple. They need the money, and while you may have less races on network TV, Fox is going to completely own the Indy 500. And I think that is something to be said because the Coca-Cola 600, we didn't talk about this yet, but I know we've talked about this on a previous podcast episode. If IndyCar were to go to Fox, May would be Fox IndyCar coverage, essentially, because the way the NASCAR TV deal has changed in the future, NASCAR won't have the Coca-Cola 600. So, and Brown goes into potential people who could call the race on Fox. Obviously, Mike Joy, Alan Bestwick, Adam Alexander, Jamie Little, Chris Myers could do the pre-race. Like, these are all pretty well-known broadcasters that would fit the bill. And I think having Fox as far as the lead-in, I think that's important. Also, and Brown touches on this, you get IndyCar rights for, you know, $25, $30 million. Well, that's essentially the cost for one cup race. So they get all the IndyCar season and the Indy 500 for essentially the cost of one cup race. Oh, and in a perfect world, you get IndyCar, as Brown mentions, as maybe a, you know, at Nashville and it's later and you have the Fox early window, or you have IndyCar in the early window, or even at primetime. Like, you get it as an NFL lead-in for some races as a possibility.
No, it's a very good point. And I think you look at the advantages you mentioned going to Fox. And I think another thing too is you want to be with a partner that invests in your series. And I think another sign that we've seen with NBC trying to cut costs is the fact that Lee Diffie is being moved to NASCAR. And I think that's still something that maybe has flown a little bit under the radar that hasn't been really fully addressed, is the fact of the matter is there are IndyCar races that will not have Lee Diffie on the broadcast later this season. And is that another cost-cutting measure for NBC? And kind of trying to pinch pennies and stuff like that. So not only do you have an NBC, an entity that's not going to give you as much money annually as Fox, they're already trying to pinch pennies to, I guess, warrant giving IndyCar a negligible bump in annual rights fees. And meanwhile, I think you look at a Fox that change is good, and we know IndyCar doesn't like to change. That's why we're having a chassis from 1972 that we're still racing with. But when you look at it in terms of change is good and, you know, some excitement around a new entity owning your rights and ideas that they can present and stuff like that. And that's not to crap all over NBC, but just, you know, new eyes and stuff like that, new personalities can kind of excite you. And I think maybe partly, at least personally for me, in watching, trying to watch practice and trying to watch qualify, is just, it's the same stuff. You know what I mean? I mean, like, I appreciate the pit reporters and the guys in the booth. I mean, they're great. It's just, you know, the topics seem to be the same. How many times we have to talk about marbles, right? Everywhere. The graphics packages are the same, all that stuff. I mean, there's no new bells and whistles that we're seeing from NBC. And based on what we're hearing or reading in Nathan Brown's article, those aren't coming with NBC. So I think new eyes, a new approach, a fresh approach, and oh, more money can be something that could be good for the sport going forward. And that's why I'm with you. I think Fox has to be the choice, at least what we, based on what we know. But I just don't know if the IndyCar brass are willing to take that leap, as opposed to comfortable in the bed that they've laid in with NBC. We'll have to see.
And two things. One, if IndyCar is going to go into the NFL season the way the NFL on Fox is set up, IndyCar would have to run basically a night race, right, for them to get an NFL lead-in for a season finale. But before that, I mean, you could at least have college football potentially as a lead-in for a race. I mean, that's worth something with Big Noon and things like that. If it's like on a Saturday or even on a Sunday, right, for Labor Day weekend, there are possibilities there. Also, you mentioned like just a fresh approach. Look, Fox does an outstanding job with their NASCAR coverage. And not that NBC is doing like some horrible job with their IndyCar coverage. I think it was a big step up when IndyCar went from ABC to NBC, right? Back in 2019, it was a noticeable boost. It's been a good relationship. It's been 5 years. That doesn't mean you have to keep going though with who you had in IndyCar for the longest time, stuck with ABC, and ABC mailed it in for the, I don't know, it seemed like for the final decade plus of that arrangement. And then right at the very end, they kind of stepped it up just a tad, and we'll see. But I think more money, and money is paramount, right? And Mark Miles said this in the article, incumbents certainly win all ties. And I get that. But if you're getting a sizable amount of network races close to that 10 number, even if it's not 10, but close. And say you get practice and qualifying guaranteed on FS2 and some qualifying on FS1, along with Indy 500 qualifying, you know, times on network, along with, again, there's no Peacock for Fox, obviously, but you do have this new streaming entity that's set to launch this fall with ESPN and Warner Brothers and Fox as an option, and maybe that's the way people go. That's how you get that audience. So that bundle plus Fox, it's a higher rated network. I think there are a lot of positives here, and sometimes you just need to try something new, right? I think IndyCar's in that spot right now.
Well, unfortunately, we're talking about a series and a ownership group that doesn't like to try new things. we'll give them credit for thermal, but that kind of comes back to it. It's like they're comfortable with the familiar, and I've grown, at least personally, stale with the familiar, and we're already seeing NBC trying to cut back and all that with IndyCar coverage in terms of investment in people on site and all that stuff. And I just think it would be a kick in the pants, not only financially, but also just how you are how you are treated, I guess, and having a new group come in and be excited about IndyCar again is kind of like what NBC was when they got it from ABC and ESPN, to be honest. And I think that would be good for the sport. All that positivity and excitement and, oh my gosh, what's NBC going to do? And they did largely deliver on those things. Now it's Fox that's kind of bringing those ideas and that investment. And I think it's something IndyCar should jump at. But we're also talking about a Penske Corp and Roger Penske that the reason why he's a billionaire is he's very smart and calculated and maybe doesn't take risks. And would it be a risk? I don't think so. But he's also very, very comfortable with the familiar. And I'm worried that's what will largely decide what IndyCar decides in this head-to-head between NBC and Fox.
Also, FS1 is a way better network currently for sports compared to USA Network. And if you get, say, a majority of races on FS1 and only like one or two on FS2 and then the rest on Fox, that's a better TV package than what NBC is offering you currently. Unless NBC is going to offer you more than 10 network races. So if you get 8 on Fox, you get 2 on FS2, and then the rest on FS1, I think that's a comparable package, and I think that's a better deal.
No, I definitely agree. I think we're both in agreement in terms of where IndyCar should go. It's just, unfortunately, you know, we're not in those meetings, and we're not making the decisions, but we'll see what IndyCar decides, and it sounds like something we could have a decision on, at least IndyCar has kind of been teasing at Mark Miles before the 500. So could we have some sort of announcement as soon as next month, potentially?
Could we even have something as soon as Long Beach? I mean, Fox, you know, headquartered in L.A., could that be a possibility for Fox Sports announcing it at Long Beach? Who knows? One other final note on this topic, Fox doesn't have the Olympic contract albatross hanging over them either.
Very true. And I know NBC has kind of bundled in the Indianapolis 500 as, you know, their champions network type thing, but it's just kind of noise now at this point, as opposed to Indianapolis 500 getting the hype solely for their event. And I think that could be something that Fox can deliver.
All right. So let's shift from TV deals to teams. And an update in terms of teams. So Marshall Pruitt with an article, Prima, very interested in coming into IndyCar next season with two cars. They'd like a veteran plus a younger driver, like potentially from Europe, you know, on their latter side entering in. And we got another nugget on this possibility. So Pruitt saying in the mailbag this week that he's heard Prima Racing among those interested in Callum Ilott. So his odds of getting back to full-time IndyCar seem to be improving for 2025. So either way, looking like Ilott, and he showed well with Arrow McLaren at Thermal. And who knows, you know, who's in that ride for David. It's either David Malukas. It's not going to be Kalamaya. He has a conflict. Theo Porcher, he tested. He was an Indy, and then he tested on the Chevy simulator in North Carolina earlier this week, so he could be perhaps the fill-in if David Malukas isn't ready. But again, Indy Open test next week and Long Beach after that. It's going to be busy time. You would hope that Malukas is ready by next week.
Yeah, you hope so, but a lot of interesting possibilities too. And the fact that the F2 champion was in Indianapolis this week, maybe still is in Indianapolis, brought a whole lot of interesting discussion or rumors on why he could indeed be in Indianapolis.
So that's probably the possibility, but you look at Prima, two more cars, Callum Ilott as a potential driver, makes sense, and then someone from Europe. And then you get to the latest on the growing grid. this is a growing problem for IndyCar that's, well, one they created on their own by not updating the chassis since 2012.
Yeah, it's I think you and I both looked at the expanding grid. There was a time where anybody interested in joining the series was huge because this series needed an influx of teams. I'm not there anymore. I ordered 27 full-time cars. This series doesn't need more teams, or at least more entries.
More full-time full-time entries. I think that's the problem, is that people are only incentivized for full-time entries in IndyCar because of the leader circle system, how that's set up. Back in the day, you used to have teams entering a handful of races, right? You get an old, like a year old chassis, and you enter a handful of races at the end of the season. Like, we used to have a lot more of that. We don't have that anymore, and I think that's why this has suddenly become a problem. It's an all or nothing proposition.
Yeah, and I think, you know, regulations too. Like, you can't run a, you know, 3-year old Honda engine or anything, you know, this year or anything like that. And of course, with two OEMs, you know, don't have the multitude of OEMs laying around either. The thing of the fact of the matter is, I look at Prima, and okay, so it sounds like they're going to have two full-time entries, Chevy-powered, and you continue to expand the grid, and you don't expand the leader circle, which is still remains at 22. And even with the charter system that's being bannered about, which we'll get to soon, it still remains at 22. And I'm saying, well, you're adding more full-time entries and not expanding the leader circle money. And I'm just like, well, what's the incentive? And two, all due respect to Prima, and I don't know a lot about them, but I look at the series that they're in and where they compete in F4 and F3 and F2, and I'm looking at them and say, what's the difference between them and Carlin? And we saw what happened with Carlin. Why am I supposed to get excited by Prima? Can you answer that question? I don't know.
I don't know enough about Prima. They're a much more winning team with more top-tier drivers than even Carlin had. I guess that's the argument.
Yeah. And
Marshall Pruitt already reporting that the Prima two-car deal could be announced in the coming weeks. They have a pair of engine leases from Chevy, so this seems like all but a formality. It will happen.
It is. I love to have, it's great to have more teams. I'm just looking at the grid going, where are these, and even some races, like, well, they can't race 29 cars. They don't have 29 spots in the grid.
Not at Mid-Ohio, not at Toronto, right?
So it's like, well, what are we doing here? I know people, I still fall back in every time I see a headline talking about a team joining IndyCar and I get excited, but then I start thinking about it. I'm like, unless current teams either disband or cut back on cars, are we starting 29 cars at events? Like, this, are we really, here's my biggest thing, are we adding to the competitiveness of IndyCar, or are we just adding cars?
Yeah.
And that's my thing. And it is such a Herculean effort to challenge Penske and Ganassi in particular. You're telling me Prima is going to come in and raise the bar of the grid, or are they just going to be two more cars out there?
Now, to be clear, you look at Prima and their history in GP2/F2. They've had Charles Leclerc, Mick Schumacher, Oscar Piastri all win. Other drivers include Nyck de Vries, Robert Schwartzman, Ollie Bierman, who's racing for them currently. So you've had a lot of top drivers, right, over the last handful of years since they've come on racing at the top level in F2. So that's, I guess, the thing you look at most is that they've had a lot of success. And the other thing is, do we expect Ganassi to really run 5 full-time cars next year? Because I certainly don't.
I don't know. As long as Kiffin Simpson's check keeps clearing, who knows what possibilities there are. But I think you look at, too, is, and Ollie Bierman is going to be in a – he could be racing for full-time in Formula One based on his performance at Saudi Arabia for Carlos Sainz. But here's my thing, is we've always talked about is kind of the way, the path to respectability and competitiveness in IndyCar is you kind of dabble and you do the Meyer-Shank approach. You know, you do like, you know, 3 races, then you do 6 races, then you build up to that full-time season. Prima's just jumping in the deep end with 2 full-time cars. And, man, that's a very deep pool that they're jumping in. I know they've had success, a lot of success in Europe, but the United States isn't Europe. And they're going to be on a learning curve. I just don't know what we're adding, at least in the short term, with Prima. And it could be a Carlin thing by the time they kind of, a couple of years down the road, either they get it figured out or they just don't move in terms of moving up in the grid, and then they're gone. And that's a concern. And then again, like 29 cars. I mean, what are we doing here? 29 cars. That's way too many. Give me 22 with all of them a chance to win a race as opposed to 29 with 10 of them having no chance to win.
Well, and that goes back to a bigger problem when you don't change the chassis, right, for so long. Right. This is what happens, right? When you're not pushing the envelope, this is what happens. You get a lot of entries. And yes, it's nice to have 27 full-time cars, but to me, 28 feels like the max of the max that you should have on any given race weekend outside the Indy 500. Now, if you're going to bring back other 500-mile races, which Penske and IndyCar have no interest seemingly in doing, even though they should be racing at Pocono, right? They should be racing at, you know, other places.
Texas,
which I don't think you need 33 there either. Michigan would be nice, but we know that's never going to happen as long as Penske's in charge and has the Detroit race. But, like, 28 is really a max number. We don't need that. And we saw that, what, in 2008? It was the last time we saw a grid that big, but that was because of reunification. The next year, we're looking at grids lucky to get to 22 every race. And granted, that was because of the recession. But this is where things are at. And I thought, and probably you thought, the hybrid would weed some teams out here. It has not done so, and maybe that will happen before next season when the true costs are released, right? Because everyone's saying, oh, it'll be $250,000. Well, now we're looking at $400,000 to $450,000, and who knows? By the end of it, could it be $500,000, right, for teams to outfit right. Everything? And maybe that's the thing that takes care of it, because before, right, anytime we looked at, oh, we could have 28, 29 cars, and then there are some entries that don't come together, some teams that reduce. Well, for the first time in a long time that I can ever remember, we didn't have that from last offseason to now. That was one of the big positive things, right? It was easy to focus on all the negative things that happened in the offseason. But IndyCar didn't have a grid reduction, which was a massive surprise. So,
and early indications are that they may not have a grid reduction going into next year, at least. And now there's a lot of time between now and March of next year that anything could happen. But I think that's one thing that IndyCar has done a very good job in growing the field in terms of entries. And that was one of their top priorities, right, several years ago, is getting more cars in the grid. They've done that. And I think it also says kudos to IndyCar in relation to the health of the teams and helping them out as much as possible, because you mentioned the amount of money having to be invested in the new hybrid technology for each of these entries, and it did not cost, at least not yet, a single car off the grid. You didn't see teams that you kind of look at as saying, okay, are they kind of fledgling when you look at Juncos, when you look at Foyt, when you look at Coyne. And yeah, Coyne has had to take paying drivers and a revolving door in there, but they haven't completely eliminated the car. And that's a separate conversation on maybe they're more advantageous to do that. But fact of the matter is every single team has kept the current cars that they had last year and ponied up the money for hybrid technology, which means that the health of those teams financially is good enough to be shelling out that much money. And that's a credit to IndyCar, for sure, and the teams. So the system has worked for IndyCar in growing entries, growing teams. We're just, it's mission accomplished. We can move on to other things, I think. And meanwhile, you still have teams, which is good, trying to enter the season. But like, if you're Prima and you're looking at it, like, what's the advantage of joining IndyCar right now? You're not in the leader circle. Maybe you're granted a charter, but that sounds to be the top 25 cars. What's the advantage for Prima? Do they really think they can come in and compete?
Well, and that's the part that when you look at teams on the outside, like Coyne, right? I mean, he's got to get the biggest check available because of what happened to them in the leader circle last year, where you had, what, one entry in Malukas able to sneak in on the leader circle. Obviously, the Stingray Rob entry did not make it. You look at Foyt last year, where they had one entry able to sneak in. And then Hukos, one entry able to sneak in. So you look at that, plus Andretti forfeiting one, and then Ganassi only eligible for three. You have a lot of cars vying for some of those final spots.
Yeah, and that's that could be the difference between some of these teams still existing year to year. But I think a lot of this, too, ties into the charter debate, which we'll get to here.
Yes, and I guess let's talk about the charter debate. Because so you look at, we talk new teams, right? And we talk about a TV deal, and now the other thing is the charter debate on what IndyCar could do on this, and we continue to get more details on how this could play out and what it would look like.
Yeah, it's a very interesting article, long article by Marshall Pruitt, but chock full of information. But it breaks down a lot of different things, and it looks mainly at the charter system and the what we know, because there's a lot of going back and forth. Of course, we talked about the series asking the owners to pay $1 million per charter, and they basically got laughed out of the room, and where the series is now in trying to build this. We know that it's a thing in Formula One. We know it's a thing in NASCAR. And for those kind of maybe unfamiliar, it basically monetizes the positions on the grid, or the teams. Is their entry, their full-time entry into the series is worth money. And to have other teams come in, they basically have to buy a charter. And it protects, it also allows these teams to maybe have, if they do have to sell, like a Carlin, for example, if they would have had a charter, they could have sold those and recouped some of their money that they lost in their IndyCar venture. But what the story basically lays out is 25 charters. And each team would be limited to three charters per team. Determining the eligible entries for those 25 charters right now is being utilized with the last season's entrance championship. So the 25 charters are granted based on last year's entrance points. The three-car limit, Chip Ganassi, which fields five entries, would miss out on having all of its cars covered under the charter program. So basically, the concept is no more than three a team. This is Mark Miles saying, everybody ran all year last year, therefore minus two that didn't make it because of the limit would be the 25. They'd have charters. So everybody who's ran last year is in, minus those two cars with Chip Ganassi. Well, then you're asking, well, what happens to Prima? Well, they don't have a charter, apparently. The 25 would have guaranteed starting positions at every race, with the Indianapolis 500 being the only possible exception, which we've talked about in terms of the blowback for that when it came out. So all 25 charter teams would start every race, similar to NASCAR. That's basically being laid out. That's no surprise. It would say that with the possibility of one or more new teams joining the series in 25, the charter system could also have a significant impact on any regular events where IndyCar is looking to place a cap on how many entries. So that's another question with Prima, is if you're in 29 cars and you can only race 27 at places like Mid-Ohio and Toronto, you have to go against Ganassi's two non-charter cars to make the race. So who are you betting on? You betting on two Ganassi cars, or are you betting on two Prima cars?
Well, depends on who's in the Ganassi seats, but yes, I think we know the answer to that.
Yeah, so that's an interesting debate. The like we said, the leader circle would not go up; would still stay at the top 22. The under the charter system, the 22 leader circle contracts wouldn't be available to non-charter entries. So again, prima, you don't have a charter and you're not eligible for the leader circle. So again, what's the incentive to join IndyCar?
Unless,
I don't really understand.
Unless a team sells their charter to Prima.
Correct.
That's and to that be clear, to me, do you have a problem with like 25 entries seems like a perfectly fine number at races outside the Indy 500?
I'm perfectly fine with 25 entries everywhere. And that's kind of my thing is I think some people's issue with the charter system is, oh, it doesn't allow other teams to play in the pool or makes it much more difficult. And my thing is kind of, well, do we need Indy 500 is different. Okay, take out the Indianapolis 500 because part-time entries, one-offs are very important to that event. But everywhere else, do we need Top Gun and Dragon Speed and all these teams that are kind of like half-assed efforts trying to race in the series? Or do we want to say, hey, if you're serious about racing in this series, you need to invest in a charter, you need to buy out a team or whatever, and you need to come and really, really, like, look at Coyne. Like, Coyne is not competing in their current iteration of what they are. So is it better off that Coyne exits the series, doesn't have a charter, and Prima comes in and say, hey, we're going to invest millions of dollars into our operation, something that Coyne couldn't or wouldn't do? I think that's better for the series. Some people think it's not good for the series because of Coyne and their decades of being in the series. But my thing is, if it strengthens your full-time teams and makes them invest in their product, invest in their team, and not just cash checks and be, you know, backfillers to the series and the grid, I think it's a good thing. I don't know how you feel about it.
I think it's a good thing. Ultimately, what matters the most is how does this play out for the Indy 500? That's all fans truly care about in this, is the guaranteed starting spots, which Penske obviously was kind of behind that push back in 2018. So it's been nothing new, and it just comes down to what do they decide for that? Is the Indy 500 separate from this, or is it included in those chartered entries? Is it essentially 25.8 2.0?
Now, that's a very interesting question because it is also addressed in Marshall Pruitt's article on Racer.com. He says, quote, there's also the highly anticipated call on whether Penske Entertainment will reintroduce the universally panned 25.8 rule. He says, like charging for charters, the return of the 25.8 rule at Indy is said to be 50-50 as of right now.
So basically, fans need to keep being really critical about it.
Yes. I would say it was probably 80-20 that it was coming back prior to the fans' outrage to it. And that's why we're back at 50-50.
Yes.
So, yeah, keep panning that anytime it comes up.
Precisely. All right. Well,
but it's also, and this is an interesting too, says it's a bizarre possibility to contemplate and one that can't be ignored, is that all due to the current decision to pick 25 as a number for charter protection this is interesting too, talking about Chip Ganassi. It says, based on their top three cars that would be in the charter, but do you make Alex Palou not a charter team to protect a Kiffin Simpson? Because Kiffin Simpson is bringing a wealth of money. Mm-hmm. And it's said in the story, not just for his ride, for the entire Ganassi organization. Do you move Kiffin Simpson into a charter car, and then you put Alex Palou in an outside charter car because you have more faith, obviously, in a two-time series champion in being able to qualify at those qualifying races as opposed to Kiffin Simpson?
I would think IndyCar would find a way to make a rule to prevent that swap from happening.
It'd be very interesting.
Because right now, right, with entrant points, it's the car number and it's not the driver.
Yeah, so I don't know if you could find a loophole or just move that. So let's say if the three car is left out, for example, you flip them and you say, well, okay, Kiffin Simpson is flipping from the three, let's say, to a car that's in. and vice versa. You just flip their cars, because if it's entry points, if it's the car, you can flip the drivers. So who knows? And then the story goes on along about talking about fair treatment for Dreier and Reinbold to potentially be left out because he's a Indy only driver, and how it would affect sponsorship. So my thing is kind of like, I like Dreier and Reinbold. I like Dennis Reinbold. I think he's good to have around. Am I worried about him because of the charter system?
They haven't competed right? full time entering a season since 2012. So I guess
still just does Indy only. He always talks about doing more races. It never happens. Okay. So if he's still doing Indy only, and as long as the 25-8 rule isn't adopted, then he'll still be fine.
But the ultimate question is, does this go live for next season? And it seems like they still have quite a bit to figure out this season.
They do, but it sounds like something they want to have finalized by Indianapolis, which the amount of hurdles they still need to make. And
that's
have
not
the,
happening.
The team owners on board. In the end, whatever happens is somebody's going to be pissed off, whether it's existing team owners, whether it's prospective team owners, whether it's the series, whether it's Indy 500 purists. I don't know, but somebody's going to be pissed off based on what happens with this. And you know, Marshall Pruitt goes in about, oh, what about the new teams like the Able Motorsports and the Primas? I kind of go back into it and say, if you want to play in this pool, then you have to be really serious about joining the party, and you have to buy a charter. And it's similar to Formula One, obviously, to extremes in Formula One, but even in NASCAR. And I don't think that's a bad thing, to be honest, outside of Indianapolis. But if you want to play in the pool, then you have to prove that you're serious about this and not coming in as a top gun or a whatever, a Lazier, right? I mean, just, mm-hmm. you know, kind of Mickey Mouse operations. And like, if you want to play in this pool, you got to be serious about it. And in that respect, I appreciate what IndyCar is thinking, because I think we do need to hold the series to a higher standard with some of these teams. You can't just come in here and run around and finish last and next to last and do that. I think for full-time entries, you need to be serious. We've talked about, you know, the 27 full-timers, really how many of those can win a race, you know, just half of them, maybe more. If you make these charters a thing and you trim the field a little bit, then you have some definite teams that are going to be heavily invested in the series. And that then raises the competitive level and balances the field a little bit.
I also think the charter system would force teams that are just taking pay drivers to think more seriously about who they're putting in seats. There's a lot more on the line there.
Yeah, or think seriously about if they want to do this long term. Like, I know Dale Coyne is a great dude. The series loves him. He's been around for so long. But is Dale Coyne's approach to competing in the IndyCar series raise the level of the series? And the answer is no. Not recently.
But you do need someone to let young drivers have an opportunity to break in. He provides that.
True. But it's almost, but even the last couple of years, you've kind of gone away from drivers that really had a future in the series to whoever's bringing a check to race for Coyne. Unfortunately. Is the series better served by a two-car Prima team instead of a two-car Coyne team? I mean, I'm not saying they are or aren't. I'm just raising the discussion in terms of competitiveness. Okay, if a Prima team comes in and heavily invests in their product and has two paid drivers and it really invests in behind the scenes and all that, is that better for the series than Dale Coyne? On the track, I would say yes, it is. But if you're looking at it and say, Dale Coyne's an institution around the series for decades, we can't push him out, then I understand that side of the coin too. But racing is a business. It is a ruthless business. And I think the charters would raise the level of competitiveness in the series. And maybe the end game is something that we've really hoped and prayed for years, is somebody other than Penske and Ganassi can win a championship in this series.
And that's, I think, the biggest thing that needs to change, is that it's more open. But you know how you get that? By having new chassis, by having more open and non-spec of a racing series. That's how you change it, plain and simple.
And I think you have teams heavily invested.
That too.
And not just taking checks, which I think right now there are just too many teams in IndyCar that are doing that.
If you agree or disagree with us, and I'm sure you may disagree with us on our discussion on that, we'd love to hear from you. You can find us at newtrackrecordpodcast.com. While you're there, sign up for the email list. It is free. You'll get anytime new episodes come out, you'll get an email along with special announcements. Check out the store. We have t-shirts and stickers for you there. You can find us on social media, IndyCar Podcast on Twitter/X and on Instagram. newtrackrecordpodcast@gmail.com is the email. On Facebook, just search for New Track Record. patreon.com/newtrackrecord if you want to support us on there, starting at just $1 a month. Thanks to Xavier and others for their support. And as always, you can download the podcast and listen in on your favorite podcasting platform: Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Pocket Cast, Podcast Addict, Amazon, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Time to take a look at the mailbag. Several things to get to. Some last thoughts on thermal. Vicky Lynn 26 says, I don't disagree with having hot pit stops instead of the halftime. I think it was Kevin Lee on Trackside that said the stalls were too short by about 5 feet. So until that's fixed, they can't do hot pit stops. So there you go on that. Lynn_IndyCar said, wow, your take on Scott Dixon was so wrong. He pretty much destroyed the field at Gateway. He almost lapped the field with his amazing fuel save, tire management, and speed. Won three of the last four. Only bad race was Long Beach, which was caused by Pato pushing him into the tires. So Dixon fans mad at you, Justin.
I'm not saying that Dixon at his best isn't still one of the top drivers in the series. I'm just saying he's making uncharacteristic errors. I think we're starting. I mean, the guy's 45 years old, people. I mean, there's going to be fall off. He's not superhuman as much as we think he is based on his performance in this sport, and he deserves all the accolades. But there is an end game. There is a point where those skills begin to diminish. And I think we're starting to see that with Scott Dixon in terms of uncharacteristic errors. That's all I'm saying.
Other thoughts? This from Lynn_IndyCar. Guys, do you think the hybrid will give a driver an advantage? I think it will give Dixon an advantage because of his ability to adapt to cars quickly. Just remember, his first championship was won with an underpowered Toyota, plus he was the initial Honda tester. I think it will give the sports car guys an advantage. That's what I think, because they've already dealt with hybrid. Like Tom Blomqvist, this will help him catch up, I guess is the way I look at it.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I think we're eagerly awaiting the hybrid era because, as you mentioned, similar to a chassis, once you reset everything and go back to zero with a particular aspect of the car, is smaller teams can find something quicker than the bigger teams sometimes. And I think, to your point, we've had the same engines, pretty much the same engines, the same chassis, right? The same setups, the same aero for a long time now. There's little secrets that teams can find to maybe offset the big dogs consistently. And this will be something that hopefully for the short term levels the playing field a little bit. And hopefully the second half of the season is unpredictable because of it.
You pose the question, who loses out with the charter system? You pose it on the podcast. You pose it on social media. Responses on social media. The Roth said, sounds like a rush to get this done, like before Prima joins the series. So who would Prima buy out to join? That's one of our obvious questions. Also, AtlantaCat99 said, interesting that there's not a single quote from any team owner or driver indicating favorable or opposed viewpoints in the entire article, except a brief mention of Dennis Reinbold, where nothing was actually quoted, just a minor suggestion of a negative viewpoint.
You know, it's interesting, but I mean, team owners have been pretty tight-lipped about this whole thing. I mean, the only on-record quote we have, isn't it from, was it at St. Pete? Was it Andretti? I'm trying to remember. I don't know if the team owners are even talking about it because so much is going on behind the scenes. I mean, could there be something there? Yeah, absolutely. I'm just not sure if there is or not.
And then someone else, as far as who loses out, Indy Nathan saying probably fans, which, well, it's probably accurate.
Well, it all depends on what that fan covets and cherishes and sees as priorities in the series. And none of them are right or wrong. I just think there are different priorities. And I think if Dale Coyne is shown the door, so to speak, because somebody wants to buy his charter, that's on him. If Dennis Reinbold is shut out of other races because he doesn't want to become a full-time team, I kind of don't feel bad for him, to be honest. But I know other people will, and that's okay.
One final thought on Thermal. This from Dobozo Rodrigo. To be honest, I still don't understand how the Thermal incident is not Herta's responsibility by jumping the start and squeezing Dixon in. I mean, that's IndyCar, right? Like, guys jump the start all the time. Elio. it's just the nature of the beast. And if you're able to time it well and not get penalized by race control, so be it.
Well, and I don't think we've seen anywhere about who was and wasn't on push to pass going into turn 1-2, which we talked about too, the absurdity of allowing push to pass from the jump with so many cars in such a confined space. That definitely could have had an impact on that too.
For sure. So that's a look at the social media submissions. One email submission this week, and let me pull that up. This from Joe Deppy. And there's a question saying, there's a question in the mailbag, the racer mailbag this week about the worst driver in IndyCar history. I'm curious on who comes to mind for you. In addition to the three that Pruitt mentioned, I'd also submit Marty Roth. His name I only remember hearing when his car was against the wall somewhere, and Dennis Vitolo, whose career highlight was taking out Nigel Mansell under caution, the 94 500. So Marshall mentioned, of course, Milka Duno. What are the other names? Dr. Jack Miller.
Yes.
And Hiro Matsushita, right?
Yes.
I would, Marty Roth is a good one. I would throw in Francesco Dracone.
Uh-huh.
Any other names that come to mind for you?
Maybe fairly or unfair. I think this is because of the investment that he and support he had somehow for zero performance, and that's Sebastian Saavedra.
Fair.
I'm not saying he's probably the worst, but
he won a pole.
Won a pole and then couldn't get the car going and caused a crash in the inaugural Indy GP, of which we were using a standing start. But I never understood the financial investment that he was able to get to support his career when he didn't do anything. That was my thing. He did 3 years of Indy Lights. Never finished above third, and then just kept getting rides. Conquest Racing, Dragon Racing, KV, and like you said, being on the pole.
Ganassi.
I just never understood how he kept getting support from AFS when he just wasn't that good.
It's all about relationships in racing, right? It's not always about talent.
No, that's across the entire spectrum of racing. That is covers a lot of things, that statement, for sure.
That wraps up the mailbag this week. News and notes, a few quick items to get to before we wrap things up. First off, tickets on sale for the Music City GP. MusicCityGP.com is the website, of course, at Nashville Super Speedway. And I was curious. I looked on the site in like the other day, and it looked like it was about, a quarter to a third tickets already bought up, which is surprising. That's some good news there.
Yeah.
As far as Long Beach coming up, not this weekend, but next weekend, Gabriel Iglesias, the comedian, will be the grand marshal of the event.
Nice. I vaguely have heard of him.
I've heard of him. I couldn't name any bits or anything that he does. Speaking of Long Beach, there will be a special chronograph watch to commemorate the race. Oma Legato Watches, so the official watch partner for that event. We have everything happening with IMS and the hybrid testing last week. You have the open test coming up next week, April 10th and 11th. And the schedule, 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. April 10th, veterans, 1 to 3, rookie orientation and veteran refreshers, 3 to 6, all drivers. April 11th, 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., all drivers. They will have the Southeast Vista and Southeast Vista I assume deck was mentioned here, grandstands, because the museum, they're doing the remodel there. So you won't be able to just be on the hillside. You'll actually have seats that you can go into. So that's cool.
Nice.
Also, both days of the open test will be on Sky Sports F1 live as well. So that's pretty cool across the pond. That's obviously a draw. You have the solar eclipse at IMS, our favorite event, coming up on Monday.
Can we just get past the solar eclipse?
There'll be a special report from NBC News live from the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Obviously, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway doing a big event as well for that. You had David Malukas at the Easter egg roll at the White House back on Monday. So representing IndyCar, Alexander Rossi was there last year. You have the IMS Verified Ticket Marketplace that is out. They have that for the first time. IMS.com/marketplace, where fans can buy and sell tickets that are secure through IMS, guaranteed tickets. You don't have to worry about scalpers ruining anything. One other note I talked about on the open test before. TBAs for Arrow McLaren for the David Malukas entry and Dale Coyne Racing. We expect it to be Catherine Legg, the other car. Obviously not confirmed. Nolan Siegel will be in the other entry for Coyne. No Able Motorsports, 34 cars.
All right, one getting bumped, which you and I agree, just start all 34.
Yes. IndyCar on Netflix now with 100 Days to Indy officially, so that's good news. And cool. The Joseph Newgarden banner's up at IMS. So for him winning the Indy 500 last year, so that is up. And then final note, one of our favorite topics, international races. An update on Brazil. IndyCar could happen at Interlagos in the future if discussions succeed with the city of Sao Paulo. That's the latest from our Brazilian friends in terms of the latest news. We'll see. We've heard this before.
In one ear, out the other until there's something more concrete.
that unfair? Yeah, no, it's fair. With that, time for our tweets of the week, and really just one. And Oliver Askew, former teammate with Pato Award back in 2020, said, finally, and tagged Pato because Pato started following him on Twitter.
I wonder what the catalyst was to finally follow him.
I don't know. It's incredible it took that long.
Yeah, pretty shocking. But, you know, about time.
Time for our random split error driver of the week. Who do we have for this week?
All right, we're going random split error through both CART, Champ Car, and the IRL. He was a constant, but maybe not a lot of people know of him. More racing in CART and Champ Car. But we're going with Mimmo Gidley this week.
Caleb. Ooh, that's a good one.
And Mimmo Gidley, he ran portions of, gosh, let's see, 10 years between CART and the IRL, sometimes in both series. For instance, 2000. Raced for Forsyth Racing and Della Penna Motorsports in CART and raced for Team Pelfrey at the Indianapolis 500. Didn't qualify for Team Pelfrey. Came back a year later with Brayton Racing at the Indianapolis 500. Did not qualify. Didn't qualify in 2002 with the Duesenberg brothers. Never started an Indianapolis 500. He was 0-3. Twice had an Oldsmobile engine. Once a Chevy engine. And was a guy that kind of just was a journeyman, raced for Chip Ganassi, raced for Derek Walker, mentioned Forsythe, never won a race, but he, and this is from his Wikipedia page, nearly retained his drive for 2002 with Chip Ganassi Racing, but Chip later suggested that they keep Bruno Junqueira over him as the Brazilian was under contract. He then raced two more races in Champ Car with Rocket Sports in 2004. And those were his final two open wheel races before going into the WeatherTech Sports Car Championship in 2014. He suffered serious injuries in the 2014 24 Hours of Daytona when he slammed into the back of a Ferrari being driven by Matteo Malicelli. And Malicelli's car lost power, rolled to a near stop on the track. Gidley hit him at approximately 120 miles an hour, diagnosed him with a broken back, leg, and arm injuries. He had 8 surgeries that took him 3 years to recover, but he has made his comeback to racing full-time in the IMSA prototypes. He raced last year and the year before in IMSA prototypes. I don't know if he's in IMSA prototypes this year, but Mimmo Gidley still wheeling the cars around the track.
And a best finish of 2nd at Cleveland in 2001. That was with Chip Ganassi Racing. Also, in 2001, was 2nd at Laguna Seca. So, good stretch of running for him in 2001. Really, the 2000 season as well with Della Penna. and Players, did a handful of races for Players Forsyth Racing. Some good results there was with Peyton Coyne and Walker in 99, and as you mentioned, Rocket Sports in 2004. Three different times tried to qualify for the Indy 500, did not qualify each time. 2000 with Team Pelfrey, 2001 with Brayton Racing, 2002 with Duesenberg Brothers Racing. Okay. Do you remember Duesenberg Brothers Racing? Because I certainly do not.
I do not. I was going to ask that very same thing to you because I am unfamiliar with Duesenberg Racing.
As am I. All right. Well, that's this week's Random Split Air Driver of the Week. Mimo Gidley obviously had a good career across kart, IndyCar, Champ Car. And one other note that actually just came down a few minutes ago. Tickets on sale now for the Ontario Honda Dealers Indy Toronto. That's the official name this year. Exhibition place July 19th through 21st. HondaIndy.com/tickets. They have two-day grandstand and general admission tickets on sale now.
All right, let's go.
All right, that does it for us this week. Next week, we'll be back with a recap of the Indy 500 Open Test at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. So plenty to get to, and then it'll be race week after that. So at Long Beach. So we're finally getting through this weird gap in the schedule, and thankfully there was plenty of news for us this week to get through it.
We always find something, don't we?
We do. We do, for sure. All right, for Justin Kinney, I am Caleb Hatch. This has been another edition of New Track Record Podcast.
Podcasts by Federated Media.